And I'm Nick.
And you're listening to The Ourchive.
Our ever-growing library of everything. 1 hour at a time.
Oh, man. I am really excited about this discovery. So what happened? You're hearing music right now that is emanating from a previously undiscovered wing of the Ourchive here. Nick, we were on our way to brunch. I'm glad we brought our microphones with us.
Always.
Yeah. And we found ourselves here in what appears to be a full scale replica of an entertainment district called Gaslight Square. As it appeared in its heyday, rollicking, there's so much revelry happening around us. Watch your step there.
Oh,
yeah. It's a little bit treacherous in here. It's so popular here. It seems like Adam and Drew must have had to park miles away. Hopefully they catch up to us.
Got lost on the way.
Yeah. We may never see them again. And that might be okay because, I mean, honestly, the looks of this place are pretty entertaining. So I'd be fine if we just kind of hung out here for the rest of the show.
Yeah.
Well, this is a good time maybe to, I guess we could talk about Gaslight Square.
I had never heard of this.
Okay, that was going to be my first question.
The answer is no.
No. So did you, when did you move to St. Louis?
About 15 years ago.
Okay.
I do have a connection to it. I'll get to that. But yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, the interesting thing for me about that is I grew up here. And had not heard of it until probably about the same time.
I think
I was around 25 or so the first time I heard about it. And that, I guess, is a thematic lead for this discussion because the more that I've learned about it in the last 15 years, the more insane it seems to me that it is not...
Talked about,
yeah, yeah. And recognized... And the only way I could think of to maybe put this in perspective for people who haven't ever had any familiarity with this is, like, imagine if you had in your city a district like Bourbon Street in New Orleans or Beale Street in Memphis, something along those lines that
just drew people in.
Thousands and thousands of people.
Live music.
Yeah, all kinds of different experiences. And it was universally popular. It, you know, made national news. People would fly in from other places in the country just to experience it.
And just like everyone in the city was there on Saturday night.
Yeah, yeah. Allegedly 10 to 20,000 people all clamoring to get into about a 3-block radius, and then it disappeared completely. Like it physically and conversationally ceased to exist within your own city.
It was like 10 years that it was just like booming.
Yeah.
Like 59 to 69, I read, but
roughly, yeah.
And then just gone.
Yeah.
Vanished
from existence.
So we're here to investigate.
Yeah, we're going to get to the bottom of it and find out what happened. And I don't know, maybe we'll uncover something of a cautionary tale for current entertainment districts. So I guess that also leads me to another question. Did you have any place like this in your vicinity or within a reasonable drive when you were... not living in St. Louis?
I don't think so. Like, you know, my hometown, Greenville, South Carolina, didn't have anything like this. It had, like, Main Street where people would go and, you know, eat and drink.
Cruise.
Yeah, cruise. but it wasn't a place that like drew in talent, like, you know, big bands, or, you know,
the Smothers Brothers did not make appearances in Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah. And then, you know, I guess the closest thing to that in Savannah was like River Street, but not even close. That was the place that people cruised. I think I might have talked about that before because it was ridiculous that people cruised on cobblestone. But there was no like central location like that where it was just like everybody went. You know, it was on holidays. You know, St. Patrick's Day and Mardi Gras and that kind of thing. But not like every weekend.
Like a regularly occurring thing. The way that I sort of contextualized this as I was hearing about it initially was that it was a lot like an area called the Del Mar Loop or a University City Loop, which is still thriving today, probably better than it's ever been, at least as far as like financially and stability wise. And there's a couple of other districts like this in St. Louis that have kind of developed in the last 10, 15 years.
Cherokee.
Various stages, yeah. And this Gaslight Square seems like it was analogous to all of them in different ways.
Yeah. I would say, like, Washington has a bunch of shitty clubs that people with shiny shirts go to and hit on each other. But it's not for people who like actual music. And I'm totally fine with, you know, electronic music and pop music, but it's that's that area in between that's just like the worst of the worst. So that kind of has that musical aspect, whereas like the Loop doesn't really have that, except for at this moment in time. Blueberry Hill, and it's got Del Mar Hall and Pageant, but those are like a little bit different.
It's a little different. Yeah. Those are like full on dedicated music venues.
Yeah. It's not something that you just like go in to see whoever is like a smaller thing. They're a little bit larger than that.
And I guess the Grove is kind of has some kind of an element to it. There's a lot of, I guess, subcultures that kind of intertwine in the Grove and Cherokee as well, I think. Like the Loop tends to be, to me, seem like it is a melting pot of sorts, but it's primarily like a student driven area. It's whatever happens to be like in the cultural zeitgeist at the moment kind of dictates what happens there to a large degree. But I think the Grove and Cherokee Street have a lot of disparate groups of people all kind of living next to each other or on top of each other and flourishing, in varying degrees.
I think you're right, though, that when you brought up the Grove, like, for my money anyway, that is the best location to go to just, like, that has the most amount of people who are there to party.
And
people will kind of float from bar to bar, and those bars often have either live shows or DJs, and there are, you know, people in the streets, hot dog vendors and stuff.
That kind of
like feel of just like, you know, walking around and just having a good time. It's impossible to get parking there. But that's a good spot for that kind of like nightlife.
Yeah.
If you like the nightlife.
If you're into the nightlife.
If you like the boogie.
That's the place to be. And I guess the one area where I feel like all of these places are kind of missing a key component maybe of Gaslight Square is that the variety of experiences that's available in any of these districts seems to pale in comparison to what was produced by the fervor of this mm-hmm. Gaslight Square at the height of its appeal. So I guess this seems like as good a time as any to talk about the history of Gaslight Square. Which, prior to chancing upon this topic, I hadn't really looked into too much. Like, I knew about it in the sort of these hazy terms that it you know, was a mid-century phenomena in St. Louis, kind of coinciding with, like, the last gasp of... Last gaslight of, I guess, the heyday of the city proper of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. As, like, the post-war years went on, St. Louis and a lot of cities like it, Detroit and Cleveland and places like that, kind of bled populace out of the city center. And as a result, lots of things happened, including what had been there before just sort of lost its luster over time in many ways. So I had this notion that this place had existed. It was popular, but didn't really comprehend how popular it had gotten, what had precipitated its development. And so I've spent about, in the last 48 hours, I've spent about 95 hours looking into this topic.
And that was while you were supposed to be researching the Eames. And it was while I was researching Charles and Ray Eames. So look for that in a future episode.
Yeah, that is forthcoming.
Last night, John dropped this bomb on me. He was like, hey, what if we did this thing that I suddenly know a lot about?
Became absolutely obsessed with.
You know nothing
with.
About. And I'm like, all right.
Yes.
Let's do it.
You're a great sport in that way. So the region that this came about in is near the western edge of the city of St. Louis. St. Louis kind of grew westward from the Mississippi River. It started on the riverfront landing and kind of grew out in a fan shape from there. And if
you're familiar with the city now, it's right where Central West End and the city kind of meet up, right?
Yes. I guess at the time it was this was called the West End.
Okay.
Because there really wasn't much
past that
beyond it. Yeah. It's now called the Central West End because if you look at the broader metropolitan area, it kind of falls right in the middle. But right nearby there, the streets that it occupied was at the intersection of Olive Street, which runs all the way downtown and straight out as far as you could basically go
to my house.
And still, yeah, you live right off of one of the streets that formed the nexus of Gaslight Square.
There's no reason to go past there on Olive. Just come to my house. We'll have
and
a good
stop.
Time.
Yeah. It'll be a party. So Olive Street and Boyle Street, which is a not as prominent of a street, but it there are pockets of it that have a lot of commerce, and it runs through some important districts. It runs through the Grove.
We watched a video, and I believe he said it went from Van Deventer to Boyle. Is Boyle, do you know, east or west of Van Deventer?
Boyle is west of Van Deventer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on my way here, I went up Van Deventer, looked to the left, and then went to the right. Just because I wasn't entirely sure. Like, I knew that area a little bit. You know, I've driven through it 100 times. It's just I wasn't sure exactly what was in that stretch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I by the time I was familiar enough with it to know kind of geographically where exactly it was, all traces were gone.
Yeah.
Like, it has been completely wiped out. Everything that was originally in Gaslight Square, as far as I know, has been eliminated. There are no structures within what is considered the district. None of the original structures are there.
There are structures. There's like a neighborhood there and they're part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But
there are some actually like pretty nice looking houses that have been, you know, built in that area.
But that's in like the past, like maybe 20 years, maybe or something. There was a yeah. stretch after that where it was just abandoned, and you know, there were people who were like, "Hey, let's revitalize this," and they'd kick around ideas, and it just didn't happen. But
yeah, could never get the money. It really was. It seems like it was absolutely abandoned psychologically by the city. Like people just didn't want to think about it or pay any attention to it. That area was, prior to World War II, one of the last red light districts in the city of St. Louis. I thought was interesting. In the wake of that, in the wake of the war, it became kind of a hive of antique dealers, scavengers, people who would just raid various work sites or demolition sites throughout the city. And collect the wares at this stretch, which was alternately called Greenwich Corners or Secondhand Row at the time. And that lasted for roughly 10 years or so before what I think is kind of collectively referred to as the origins of Gaslight Square, which happened somewhere between 1957 and 1959, when two brothers named Paul and Richard Muttrix purchased a building that was at the corner, I believe, of Boyle and Olive, called the Musical Arts Building, which has kind of a storied history itself. I guess it was a school facility for musical performance, art, and let me see here, Betty Grable was there. I think she learned to dance there. Vincent Price, who is a St. Louis native, he took classes there. So it stretches back a little bit, but at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of economic development in that area, but these two brothers bought it and decided to open up a cafe, saloon, bar called The Gaslight.
Okay.
And so they kind of... some of the other shops and storefronts that eventually became associated with the heyday were already in place. Like, they already existed there. But the momentum really gets started with this development of the Gaslight. And then almost immediately, that momentum gets cut off by a tornado in 1959.
Oh, man.
Yeah. A cyclone whips through there and says... don't even try it, Muttrux brothers. it destroys the building, the Musical Arts Building.
Oh, no. Wait, how long was it up?
I'm not sure when the building was built, but they took it over somewhere between 1957 and 59.
Okay, so just
their a year establishment, or two. Yeah, had just been there for a year or so. And it takes out a lot of the buildings there. And I think... in many cases, when that has happened historically, at least in St. Louis, when you have a natural disaster like that, what tends to happen is people collect the insurance money and move somewhere else. Mm. I noticed a lot of it when the flood of 93 hit. The government bought up a bunch of land and people moved out that didn't rebuild in their area. Where we're actually recording this was hit by a cyclone in 1896, and a lot of the houses around here were knocked out, and people moved to other neighborhoods, didn't restore it. But for some reason...
You're going to tell them where we are. We're going to have all these creepers creeping up.
They're going to be creeping up. For some reason, the owners of these establishments in this secondhand row decided to use the money from the insurance claims to rebuild in the same location.
And what people are supposed to do with insurance money.
Right, yeah. Instead of just abandoning what's left there, they actually restored it and made it even better. And that those two things, the influx of development money and the sort of entrepreneurial spirit of these Muttrux brothers, kind of led to a renaissance in the area with people who suddenly had a lot of money to invest, but also I guess, a sort of an aesthetic or stylistic bent in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Because these guys were, and ladies, were antique collectors or vendors, they were pretty well accustomed to reclaiming materials. Okay. And this is all going, it's all coinciding with the redevelopment of the riverfront in St. Louis for the Gateway Arch. Gateway Arch.
I wonder if that also like contributed to the style, because like I know that there were like some speakeasy style places that came up there, which is older than that period.
I've saw several references to it as having like a kind of a heavy nostalgic mm-hmm. bent to it, and that certainly carries through a lot of the musical acts that eventually became popular,
which we
there.
Haven't said yet, but
It was
jazz and blues, like
primarily a music district.
Yeah,
and it kind of spanned the jazz of the time, the sort of modern jazz of the time, going all the way back to like Dixieland and ragtime.
Yeah, but was all across the board in general. It's just like that was kind of the most popular, I guess.
Kind of what it's known for. Yeah, there were folk venues, there were operatic venues. So yeah, it was all kinds of entertainment. But so the
no barbershop singing, strangely. It was the one thing that they said no to.
If only they had heard Adam read them The Making of a Sandwich, they might have had the forethought to, you know, put a microphone in front of him and make him sing. The arch grounds are being redeveloped. This is 40 city blocks that are full of Victorian structures, and they're kind of wiped out systematically over the course of a decade or so. And so these secondhand row people are heading down there and pulling out crystal chandeliers and marble countertops and all kinds of this ornate material and accents, and taking them back to what is starting to be referred to as Gaslight Square as a result of the Gaslight Cafe.
And you might be getting this, but like they eventually line the street with gas lights.
Mm-hmm.
So taking that name and running with it and putting a theme to it. Now, here's the thing that I don't get about St. Louis. It's a street, not a square.
Yeah.
It's not even a single block, which might lead to it being called a square.
Consider that a square. Yeah. A modest rectangle even.
But it's like three blocks in a line.
Yeah.
That's a square. And then I do know the reasoning behind the loop, which in my experience is just a street, but it's called the loop. It's just wrong. It's just
That owes to the streetcar loop being there. So there's there's a more legitimate reason for the loop to be called the loop than there is for Gaslight Square to be called a square.
But the trolley hasn't been around for, I don't know how long.
I think they started to phase it out in the 60s, early 60s.
Yeah. And we're still calling it the loop.
Yeah, yeah. Well, eventually it will be.
In another 40 years.
Yeah. When the new trolley emerges. Yeah. Although it doesn't actually loop from what I've seen. Like it seems to come to a stop, like right around the library.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually go around the loop or anything, but that's neither here nor there. So Gaslight Square starts to take on this identity, unlike anything else in the city. And people start opening up more, a wider variety of businesses and making them primarily performance or drinking establishments or cafes. And this happens in earnest over the course of about 3 years, between like 1960 and 1963, the Gaslight Square, as it is most fondly remembered, takes shape. And I'm going to propose a round of elistination.
Oh, no.
Elistination.
This is going to go really fast.
Elistination names of establishments in Gaslight Square.
Are you looking at them?
I'm looking at them. Yes.
All right. I want to say CC's.
I don't know. No, that's not on my
like,
list.
It's like it's something with a red carpet.
The red carpet. Yes.
All right.
That's good. What else you got?
Wait, it's your turn. No, even if you're looking,
I have the whole list. Yeah. Okay. What I'm going to do? Just I'm going to run through these real quick.
Is it on here?
Yeah, okay, I think.
Go ahead.
There are. Nick is looking at a copy of a musical tour of Gaslight Square, which has recordings that were recorded in venues.
All right. Let's hear the list.
You good? All right.
Yeah.
So the musical arts building held.
Pepe's a Go-Go. Is that?
Yes.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
The musical arts.
I got one more. This is off memory. O'Connell's.
O'Connell's, yes, yeah, of course.
I only remember that because that was like one of the last places that was there.
But, yeah. Referred to in many instances as the like last ember of the core Gaslight Square. We'll get to O'Connell's in a bit, but there are some fantastic establishment names here. Starting with the Crystal Palace, which is probably... If not the heart of Gaslight Square, at the least, it's maybe the id of Gaslight Square. This was started as an antiques store by a guy named Jay Landsman, who's a St. Louis native.
Then it was turned into the world's first escape room. Way ahead of its time.
That's just how innovative these people were. Jay Landsman was born Irving Landsman, and as a teenager, he read The Great Gatsby and changed his name to Jay.
Awesome.
It's fantastic.
And it's great that he was born for this.
Yes, yeah. It was like the culmination of everything he'd aspired to, whether he knew it or not. I don't know exactly when he opened the Crystal Palace. It was originally in a different location, I guess closer to downtown. And he eventually, in the 50s, moved it out to the Gaslight Square area. But he started a journal or a zine that was based in New York called Neurotica. This was like late 40s, early 50s, and featured a lot of, for the time, very progressive... artists and writers, a lot of the beat writers like Ginsberg, Carl Solomon, published in it. And
it's a great name.
Yeah, it is. It's in a way, it's incredible that they chanced upon this name that long ago.
Yeah,
you know, it's like a reaffirmation that people have been just as twisted.
High school zine, the first domino. If you send me $1.25, I'll send you a copy of that.
So he uses his connections in the literary scene in New York to bring in some really incredible talent to the Crystal Palace, which was kind of a cabaret theater that also had a restaurant attached to it as well, including people like the Smothers Brothers, who had a residency there. Barbara Streisand before she was ever Barbara Streisand.
Huge. That's crazy.
Woody Allen as a like stand-up comedian. Lenny Bruce before he really took hold in New York. A lot of these names that would eventually go on to be forebearers of
huge
cultural shifts and identities. Before they ever made it, they appeared in Gaslight Square. And that's largely Jay Landsman and his wife, Fran's, doing. So that's the Crystal Palace. The Three Fountains is another big establishment that was started by the Muttrix brothers in that musical arts building. They had this idea.
How do you spell the
Muttrux
brothers?
M-U-T-R-U-X.
Muttrux.
Muttrux, okay. Yeah.
What? What's the derivation of that?
I don't know. Yeah.
Never heard that name.
As far as I can tell, they were first generation Americans. So their parents immigrated and then they were born in the United States. But I don't know.
Do you think from where they made up their name?
I mean, it would. There are worse names that one could make up. But
no,
not many. No. So the Three Fountains was a high-end French restaurant.
Yeah, and they had fine dining there. It wasn't just clubs.
Yeah, yeah. At one point, the I don't know who coined this phrase, but that Three Fountains restaurant was apparently considered one of the most elegant restaurants in the United States. It was nationally or internationally known. One of the most famous locations, at least as far as its iconography, is Smokey Joe's Grecian Terrace, which was a coffee shop famous for its outdoor patio and the Greek columns that were established on its boundaries. And so a lot of the most prominent photos of Gaslight Square during its heyday and after feature the Smokey Joe's towers, columns.
I'm intrigued by that name because Smokey Joe sounds like a Kansas City barbecue restaurant. And it's Grecian, what, palace? What did it, no.
Terrace.
Interesting name.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And that... I was gonna say that Dylan played there. He may have played there, but he definitely played at one of its neighbors, the Laughing Buddha, which was a folk music venue. All right, so we're just gonna rapid fire through some of these. Jack's or Better, Port St. Louis, Mr. D's, that was a steakhouse. Marty's, which was a sing-along piano bar.
That was before
bar.
He became a captain.
And then you get into like the international cuisine. Tortilla Flat, Kotobuki, which is a Japanese cuisine. And then a lot of stuff owing to like St. Louis's origin or that nostalgic idea. There was a place called the Roaring Twenties. There were a lot of vaudevillian places throughout here. The Left Bank, the Islander, the Club Trebien, the Living Room, the Black Horse, and what might be my favorite among them, this was a place served beer and had ragtime jazz. It was called Your Father's Mustache.
That's awesome.
And that's just the beginning. So I'll link to a map that shows all of the establishments that were considered in a part of Gaslight Square during this time. And you can read all of these names. There are many more of them, but we'll put that in the show notes.
That international cuisine kind of thing, mm-hmm. Like where I grew up, significantly smaller than St. Louis, but still kind of, for its time, a developing modern mm-hmm. city. When I was a kid in the late 80s, like, we had Great Wall of China. That was like the most crazy exotic thing ever. And even like Mexican restaurants weren't like a staple, like nowhere near what they are today. You know, it's just like there were probably some, but it wasn't something that we went to. It was still a little bit
weird.
It
wasn't like ubiquitous or anything. Yeah.
Which is East Coast. I'm sure West Coast, they started coming in more early, but I, you know, if there were Japanese and French restaurants when I was a kid, I didn't know about them.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just not my parents' thing to go to it, but it wasn't until like Kanpai of Tokyo, where it was like these chains that kind of like...
Yeah. Or you start seeing them in airports and malls and stuff.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that probably was great at the time and drew people in like crazy. It was
just
like you could go to all of these different places and get a flavor for the world.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine just knowing, and maybe this will make more sense when we get to sort of the decline and the sort of the way the city kind of turned its back on this whole era. It's absurd that there was this much culture in a place that, broadly speaking, doesn't really care about culture, or doesn't put its money where its mouth is, I guess, in terms of valuing those types of experiences, or hasn't traditionally. The notoriety of the square, like I think you mentioned earlier, the on a weekend in the heyday, it would just swallow thousands and thousands of people coming from all over the St. Louis region, but also I read references to conventions that would be scheduled in St. Louis just so that the attendees could experience Gaslight Square. In 1962, I think, Time Magazine did a report on Gaslight Square. Had a really great write-up on it. I think it's 1961 where the city officially adopts the name for that stretch, and that's when the actual gas lamps come in.
Okay.
Laclede Gas switched out all of the streetlights and put in gas lamps. And then 1963 is kind of when it reaches sort of the commercial peak, and that's when you're starting to see these hordes of people every night packing the sidewalks, and sort of in there, the intent behind it was that it was a place to go out. It wasn't just like, driving down the strip and finding some place to have dinner. It was like an occasion for these people. And it's extremely hard for me to imagine that many people in the St. Louis region actually like dedicated to going out, having a night out. But if that was the case. So I've got this link here that was published in St. Louis Magazine. And this is, basically what they do is they take a photo and then have a writer sort of piece together this prose-like caption for it. And so we'll put a link to this in the show notes so you can see the photo. And this is the caption that accompanies it. And it's, I think it's down the street from the Grecian towers that are the columns. You can kind of see them in the background there. But the caption says, "This is what a peak looks like. This is Gaslight Square soon after Laclede Gas swapped in gas lights for streetlights, a year after a Time reporter visited the city and wrote a florid article about a three-block oasis of nostalgic frivolity, where some 50 gaudily atmospheric taverns, cabarets, restaurants, and antique shops are packed together in fine fin de siècle jumble. It's a year before the murder of a respectable married lady at her own address, 4254 Gaslight, a year before the waterfall of newspaper stories about beatings, rapes, muggings, murderers, always occurring at the square even when they didn't. The square was Lady Frankenstein, where spiffy bohemians like the Muttrux brothers dressed up Victorian buildings with frippery scavenged from other torn-down Victorian buildings. They hung multiple chandeliers from one ceiling, installed gingerbread on interior walls, strung up beaded curtains made from billiard balls."
Gingerbread?
That's what it says. "And then they cemented it together with ghosts. There was jazz, but more so Dixieland and ragtime. Yet this weird tumbling together of past and present head shocked us into the future. In Gaslight, the color line washed away. Beatnik girls with pixie cuts padded the streets in flats, and poets set up typewriters on corners. It was New York and New Orleans all at once. But it wasn't, because it was here. It was ours. And then Gaslight died. It happened for a lot of reasons. Changes in American culture, racism, attempts to control it or make a quick buck of it. But ultimately, perhaps it was that St. Louis didn't believe it deserved something so wild and beautiful."
Beautiful.
It is really well said. That is Stephanie Russell, who's a culture editor for St. Louis Magazine, and this was 2011 when that was written. And so that you kind of get a sense from that, I think, what is typically blamed for what ultimately happens to Gaslight Square. And I think, like, I remember asking my parents about it, and like the answer, being something
go
along
to your
the
room
lines of, stop asking questions. We don't talk about Gaslight Square in this house.
Wow.
No, I think like if you ask anybody who had maybe just a peripheral association with Gaslight Square, they would probably tell you that it was crime that killed it. Hmm. And there was a murder in 1964. A woman was killed in the area. But the majority of the research that I've looked at suggests that the crime wasn't really the problem so much as the perception of crime, which I think is the case in many situations like this.
Well, if you don't mind me interrupting, like,
yeah,
the places we've talked about all have that same perception. Mm-hmm. The Loop, the Grove, and Cherokee Street. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think, like, I mean, really, if you, what you've got here is you've got, like, with all of those at a certain point in time, cheap properties that people buy up, mm-hmm, turn into something that is entertaining, and suddenly you have a rise in people going and getting drunk, and tons of people, you know, I talked about the Grove, the parking situation, so you have tons of people in this tight little area that are, right, parking off in other areas. And then it kind of creates a situation where there are easy targets for crime.
Yeah.
Where you have these people stumbling off to their cars and, you know, people in the surrounding areas of this area that just happened to blow up have these, you know, like I said, easy targets.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, you said, you know, one murder happened. And it's that kind of thing where it's just like those make the headlines, but there's still probably, even then,
oh yeah,
lots,
yeah,
of break-ins,
car thefts, yeah, lots of, yeah, like petty vandalism and stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. And I think you kind of mentioned there too, like, you've got a lot of people who are going into this place and getting drunk and
letting their guard down,
not, yeah, maybe not making
the smartest
decisions in every case. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think that what a lot of the people who lived through this era have said, that side of it is under, not to, diminish the crime element, but that part of it, the people who were going there was a much bigger factor, according to them, in the decline than the crime. Mm-hmm. The crime sort of compounded things, but somewhere in like 63-64, either because landlords start letting in whoever wants to be a business owner, or because zoning laws were changed, I couldn't find any specific reason that this happened, but the types of proprietors starts to shift. And what a lot of people refer to as like fast buck,
right,
exploitative developers come in. And so instead of having establishments that are dedicated for like a purpose of like eating or a performance venue where you actually have talent that is giving you a show and you're paying to see a show, you start getting more like discos with go-go dancers, and it's like just a place to go and drink. There's, mm-hmm, no entertainment value in it for that. And this was brought up in a lot of...
Why do you have to shit on go-go dancers?
All right. I love go-go dancers. But they were frowned upon, at least retrospectively, in Gaslight Square. And this came up so many times in the stuff that I was reading. The relaxing of dress codes being a big factor. So at some point, a dress code became common in a lot of these clubs, sort of jacket and tie dress code. And I sort of wonder if that was because they already had a hint of this problem as it started to get popular, and they said, no, we need to try to put a stop to this.
That's why we have a dress code at the Archive.
Absolutely. And yeah.
wearing my jacket right now.
It's a beautiful tux, Nick.
Thank you. Yeah. exclusively white tuxes here at the archive.
But at some point, these other establishments kind of dropped that. And so there wasn't as much of an association with this region with like the dressing up to go out as there had been. And a lot of people point to that as what initiated or precipitated the decline. Because you do then get in people who are not interested in the entertainment. They're just going there because they know there's a lot of people there. Or whatever reason people go to places to get drunk and whatever. But so these factors all sort of happen concurrently. And then on top of that, the city seems to just kind of stop caring. Mm. Like, and maybe it's because they had bigger issues. This is, again, when you're seeing a lot of population decline broadly in the city. And so they probably had to pick their battles. But for whatever reason, there's not a lot of investment going on culturally in the Gaslight Square area. So it starts to decline. The crime becomes...
Now, was that population decline because of people spreading the suburbs?
Yeah, mostly. I think industry starts moving out too. And mm-hmm. you start having like a lot of people, a lot of businesses... move their headquarters out of the city and into like Clayton or something, which is like a neighboring suburb, one of the sort of immediate ring of suburbs around the city. And crime is a problem. Like it is pervasive in this period throughout the city, but because, like you mentioned, there are a lot of targets in this area, it becomes known as a place that's dangerous and people stop going there. So we've had like 5 or 6 years maybe of a really good thing going on in Gaslight Square. And then starting around 1965, club owners begin to sell or move out. And what basically happens is nothing comes in to replace them. Or what comes in to replace them, it doesn't have any lasting value. Mm. And so that goes on. It's sort of a slow bleed. And then 1972...
Wait. 1966, the Allman Brothers came to town.
Really?
But they weren't known as the Allman Brothers. They were the Allman Joys. And they were like a boy band, like the Beatles. Nothing like what you picture if you picture the Allman Brothers. Check out the show notes. We've got a flyer for when while they were
fantastic.
Here. They stayed in town for like 6 months. And were just like scraping by. This was before they hit it big, obviously. And there was like a stretch in here that they were like barely making enough money to eat. There's an article where they talk about how like there was periods of days where they weren't showering and weren't sure where their next meal was going to come from, and like considering going into restaurants and ordering a bunch of food and then being like, he says something like, "Hey, how about giving a good American a free meal or something like that after they get it?" But yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting.
That is interesting, and that sort of alludes to another reason why things might have changed for Gaslight Square, and it was just taste. Like,
And a bunch of these hippie beggars. The Allman Brothers who don't ruined Gaslight
pay
Square
for their food. but like 60 after 65, 66, like the whole what culture thinks of as cool changes. Mm-hmm. And this was a very old-timey, like sort of backward-looking place. There were a lot of forward-thinking people, but the appeal of it, the entertainment, was sort of rooted in older stuff. A lot less progressive than maybe some of the areas that became popular later, like San Francisco, you know, the Haight-Ashbury type mm-hmm. of thing. Like this is not necessarily appealing to that same sense. But so that continues slowly. And then 1972, O'Connell's, which mm-hmm. is an Irish, ish pub. And it's been there for, if not from the beginning, very close to the beginning of the rise.
Rise.
O'Connell's moves out. It is considered the last remaining true establishment, or not the last remaining one, but its departure from the area sort of signals the closing of the chapter. Yeah, it's done. Gaslight Square is no more. And that moves to the south side of the city, where it still is today.
I was wondering, I feel like I've been to an O'Connell's, but that's such a generic Irish bar name that I wasn't sure.
It is still there. It's in the location that it moved to, and the same guy who runs it, he was, I guess, like a busboy originally, and then he worked himself up to bartender, and then he kind of bought the owning interest in the restaurant. Mm. So he moved it, and he still owns it, and he has an antique store upstairs.
Awesome.
Which kind of pays tribute to, I guess, the origins of Gaslight Square, and a lot of the furnishings in the current restaurant are from the original one. So it is like the one area that you can go and still have like a direct connection to Gaslight Square.
I mentioned that I had a connection to it.
Yeah.
About 5 years after I moved here, 4 or 5, I worked at Brandt's in the Loop.
Oh yeah. I was going to get there too. Yeah. Yeah.
John, if you can, what's the radio station that had the YouTube video that you sent me?
The radio station.
Isn't it a radio? It's K-E something.
Oh, K-E-T-C?
K-E-T-C?
Yeah, that's the local PBS TV station, yeah.
John shared a video with me and I was watching it, and Jay Brandt is in it, and he's talking about how, so when it comes up on the screen the first time, it says, Jay Brandt, busboy at the red carpet. And I thought this was hilarious because he went on to own a couple of restaurants, and one of them was this place that I worked at in the Loop. It's no longer there, but, he's talking about how he was a busboy there and all these great shows that were there. And it kind of, goes back and forth cutting to him talking and all the actual events and people, performers and stuff. And then finally at the end of the video, it comes back around and says, hey, you remember that busboy from the red carpet?
Owner.
Yeah.
Brands. Yeah.
So there was a reason for that, but... they did kind of like a revival reunion kind of thing. I think maybe when what they're talking about was before I started working there, but Mae Wheeler was in the video. She was a singer that passed away, I think, in 2011. She was performing there pretty regularly. She was a delight, super nice lady. And what's Gianna Trevor, something like that, played there also, sang there also. So I had these people who were kind of local legends that I was actually a busboy at Brandt's. So someday I'm going to go on and own my own restaurant.
Yeah.
It wasn't ever impressed upon us who these people were. It was just they're playing.
They're the entertainment tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you would definitely get a crowd that kind of shifted, and more people would come in. It was obvious that they were popular, but I didn't really know their historical context. Only that they fucking swang and it was actually enjoyable. But I'm just running around bussing tables and didn't get to, sit and enjoy it.
Savor it or anything. Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool how many people who kind of got their start or had some kind of introduction to a certain sect of the St. Louis cultural scene, eventually went on to do other stuff or have some kind of cultural antecedents to Gaslight Square as a result of that. Jay Brandt, so he did Brandt's, which kind of became a staple in the Loop for 10, 20 years, something like that.
Mm. Oh, and I wanted to bring up, because you mentioned Smokey Joe's had the outdoor terrace area.
Yeah, yeah.
Jay once told me that he... after going to Europe, introduced patio dining to St. Louis. Like, it had never existed before. And I always thought that was weird to me. Like, it was just like, people never thought about putting chairs outside.
He did that?
Yeah. It was like, it wasn't a thing, and he made it happen. And, yeah.
That's awesome. So he kind of reminded me of, do you know Thomas Crone?
Yeah, the Thomas Crone Affair.
Yes,
yeah.
Thomas Crone Affair.
Love that movie.
He's when not engaged in that affair, he he's a local kind of gadfly raconteur, but also he wrote a book, The Oral History of Gaslight Square, and he was a busboy.
Wait. The name of the book is The Oral History of...
The Oral History of Gaslight
Square. It's not an audiobook?
Not yet, but...
I think it should
be. I think
be.
We should angle for that, yeah. I think we basically did it tonight. We've created the audiobook.
Hey,
yeah,
all right.
So you're welcome, Thomas. But he was a busser at O'Connell's, at the new O'Connell's. And so that's how he got to know Jack Parker, who was the owner. And he's now gone on to open his own bar, the TikTok Tavern in South City. So there's like these, even though the space itself has been completely changed and none of the structures are still there, there are these like little remnants and connections that continue to kind of trickle down throughout St. Louis. And a lot of the artifacts of the era are still around.
Cat.
yeah. So if there's a popular place in St. Louis, the City Museum, that we've probably mentioned before on the show, you can see some of what was originally in Gaslight Square. Some of the ornamental stuff is there or in the collection. What kind of started me on this?
Do they have like an area that's like dedicated to that and labeled, or is that just?
They don't. I think Beatnik Bob's is supposed to be kind of a tribute to it in a certain sense.
Okay.
This is a cafe on the, not the top floor, but like the third or fourth floor.
Third, yeah.
But I, a lot of the reclaimed...
That whole place is
architectural, elements. Some of those came from Gaslight Square, and some of them were probably originally the stuff that was raided from the Arch Grounds, or what's now the Arch Grounds. What kind of started me on this journey was I went to a place called Joe's Cafe,
which
is near the Loop.
Mm-hmm.
And in the yard, which is kind of a sculpture garden of sorts, of Joe's Cafe, one of the original Gaslight Square signs is still there. And then I think there's some other stuff there that came from Gaslight Square too.
Joe's Cafe is one of my favorite places in the city.
It's like, amazing. This is my first time there, and
I could do a whole episode on that. Like,
yeah,
it is. Okay. It's basically like a mini city museum, which, you know, City Museum is one of the highlights of the city, that anytime somebody comes into town and they're like, where should I go? That's like on the top three places that you tell them to go. But the amazing thing about Joe's is that it's in a neighborhood, like literally just in the middle of a neighborhood, that every building around it is a house. It's just the only thing there. And then it's only open on Thursdays. They don't serve, it's BYOB, and they only serve popcorn and coffee, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. I'm not even sure.
But it's just this weird, eclectic, like, kind of hippie. I don't even understand it. It's just
That's the absolute best way to describe it.
Yeah.
I don't even understand it.
I've been there like three or four times in my 15 years, and even though it's nearby to me, it's just, you don't think of it, you know?
Yeah.
But one time I had a friend coming into town, and I brought him there, and there was this, like, you know, like this hippie traveling family playing, that they all played like xylophone-ish instruments, and there's like 15 of them, and it's like three generations, you know, like this weird Partridge Family kind of thing, but even more hippie. And they were incredible. And it's like this room that only fits like 30, 40 people in it. And then they have this like back lot that's just gorgeous, like again, weird, eclectic, like garden that you, has little pathways that you can walk around, and they have like a giant big boy or
who's now headless. Like the big boy's head is like no longer on his body, but it's still out there.
Anyway, interesting place.
Yeah. I think the City Museum and Joe's carry on kind of that spirit of repurposing things and really drawing out the kind of intrinsic value or finding new value in them that was sort of started by Gaslight Square. And I kind of think, to bring this back around to the beginning, like in some ways Cherokee Street kind of echoes that too. It's, you know, this influx of younger entrepreneurial people who don't really have a lot of money or prior experience running businesses, but they have like a space that has like really good bones and, you know, they're just doing something that they want to do and people kind of eat it up.
Yeah.
So it's, I think even though physically Gaslight Square no longer exists, it does still have its thread throughout St. Louis. It's just not spoken of really. It's not acknowledged, which is still kind of strange and irritating, but I think we've taken care of that problem with this episode. So
you're welcome.
We have spoken. Well, I guess it's going to be a long walk back to the car wherever Drew and Adam parked it. So
yeah, we got to find this.
I guess we should get moving. Yeah, we don't want him to end up at Smokey Joe's.
But we should come back here. This is a nice little corner of the archive.
It's great. Yeah, I would love to revisit it, or I don't know, maybe find some neighboring vicinities.
Did you say this was built to scale?
Yeah.
Okay.
Look out, those columns. Next time on the archive,
the old internet.